Bam, 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 bam,
da, 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 da. And here we are. Welcome again to another episode.
Well, he was singing with me.
Welcome to another episode of Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. Again, it's Matt Ross. Again, with my very musical host, or co-host. Guest host. Michael Pontone. And tonight, we're looking at What Are Little Girls Made Of? From Star Trek's first season. Mike, we just finished watching What a Little Girl's Made Of, and I know they're not made out of sugar and spice and everything nice. More like circuits and no shirts, apparently. So what do you think of this episode?
Once again, what the hell did I just see? What were they smoking in the writer's room? Who decided that this was a finished script?
I could tell you. This was rewritten so many times because the actual story was written by a man named Robert Bloch.
Oh, he did the Psycho.
Yes, he did. He also wrote a lot of fan fiction of H.P. Lovecraft stuff, so much so that they had to rewrite it so many darn times, 6, 7, that was mainly because they were afraid they were going to get sued by the numerous people that have used this very similar story of a hidden base of robots underneath the ice, stories from 1940s, 50s, robots type of genre stories, lots of things. So that's also why you had commented, so it seemed like they needed filler. It's probably because they rewrote it so many darn times that they took out all the things they didn't want to get themselves sued over.
Okay, well, you know what?
But that's why it was like what it is.
Let me start with the storyline synopsis. I found a much more edited version on IMDb. So we are looking at Star Trek The Original Series, Season 1, Episode 7, What Are Little Girls Made Of? The crew of the Enterprise arrive at planet XO3 with some trepidation and great anticipation. They are there to see if they can locate the renowned scientist Dr. Roger Corbry. The man hasn't been heard of for 5 years, and the general belief is that he is dead. For Nurse Christine Chapel, however, a reunion with Corbry would be a reunion with her fiancé. They find Corbry alive, but when Kirk and Chapel beam down to the planet, they find a man obsessed who is using alien technology to reproduce the humans around him in the form of androids. Okay, I got a million and one questions here. I don't know where to start.
Okay, you tell me where you want to start. Or actually, what I'd like to just start with is that last time I had said that we had the first hearing of Majel Barrett. But actually, if you take a look at it in timeline, you first saw her in The Naked Time. And every time's a naked time. But she was in that episode, but that was filmed out of order. This is actually Majel Barrett's first episode as Nurse Chapel. The story behind it is she actually dyed her hair blonde, and Gene Roddenberry walked past her and then went, "Majel, is that you?" So she was hired. But I'd like to just start with just having her there, because originally it was supposed to be a rich woman asking the Enterprise to go explore for this missing person of hers, or ex-lover Roger Corbry. But what'd you think of Majel Barrett in this, her as Nurse Chapel? I personally found her to be kind of a insipid weakling in this type of episode. What did you think?
Pointless. I don't know why they didn't just use Yeoman Rand, who had a lot more spunk and personality and agency. Where is everyone else, by the way? Where's McCoy, Scotty, Geordi? I mean, not Geordi, Takei, Sulu, is what I have to say.
This is actually, this episode cost a lot of money in 1966 dollars, $211,000, because they had to make the huge underground set. As Matt Jeffries said, they always had to remake a planet every time, including some very interesting stalagmites. So this is one of the few episodes where McCoy doesn't show in. He had actually said he only signed on for 7 out of 13 in the first season, and this is one of the ones that he did not actually do. The other ones, they didn't have them there. You did have, though, Uhura and Spock in this, and a whole bunch of, the very first time, by the way, of redshirting people. That's what you have in this episode. That's what this episode's famous for, besides robots, a recurring theme, as you'll discover in all of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And a theme that seems to be quickly forgotten once we get to Next Generation and beyond.
Well, here's the thing. I could do my own headcanon here, right? To say that these androids are obviously nowhere close to Data. Like, maybe they have a very short lifespan. Maybe they cannot do complex calculations. Perhaps they're just little more than if we were in the 21st century to, like, graft an AI bot onto a form that looked like a person. I mean, it doesn't have Data's strength, his physical resiliency, his positronic brain, the fact that he'll probably, live forever. The Sons of Soon, if they had not died of violence, would have gone on and on for thousands of years. That doesn't bother me that much, because it's just like, okay, when did we get the first... The iPhone came out in 2007, and it was revolutionary. And 10 years earlier, we had the Palm Pilot, which was doing a lot of the same things. But obviously, one...
No love for BlackBerry? What are you kidding me?
No, but I'm just saying, earlier, we had something that was close, but obviously, things only become known when they reach a kind of state of perfection, not when they're in the first iteration. So,
well, that's true.
That doesn't bother me too much.
The one thing that I found, I do like portions of this episode. I will tell you, the hidden underground city, I like that idea. I wish we actually got to see it, other than a couple of rooms and some nice stately wooden furniture. That idea of a hidden technology in an underground cavern and an underground society, I found interesting. I thought that was an interesting a concept that could have been fleshed out more. But, we only have 45 minutes with, between commercials and so forth. But so I guess we got what we got. Seeing that the scientist, which we don't know, he's actually a mad scientist, wants just Captain Kirk to beam down is a little odd, I would have to say. I would have just said no. Then we wouldn't have our story.
No, but none of this made any sense. Like... What we were left with was... The problem with this episode was that it was just a premise. It's just a premise. Nothing actually happens.
No, that's true.
You beam down there. There's a premise that there's this guy who is making... is
a
making
robot. Androids
to replicate people that he's lost. It doesn't... It's all over the place. First of all, how did he die? We don't really get that.
Well, no, he said he was freezing to death. I mean, you, again, have to make up your own headcanon, and I'm sure there's some books out there. By the way, if anyone wants to contact us and tell us, you can always email at us at yellingatgas@gmail.com. But, it's probably something like if someone wrote a story. He said he was freezing to death. I guess his expedition was failing. Maybe Dr. Brown was dying as well. But who found them? How was he able, if he had no legs, as he says when he's ever getting close to the end? How did he get in there? And we also meet the very alien Ruck, who's obviously who's very huge in this story over here. That was like, what, did that guy just take him in? We meet the very alien machine, or somewhat alien machine, guarding this place. Why would he take people on in if his job is to protect so many things inside of this alien system? But even if you forgive all that, it is a little weird that that he's been hiding out here for 5 years with other expeditions and being sent there. Was he just avoiding them? Maybe. Who knows?
Well, no,
what is he doing in the rest of it?
Where did Ruck come from? Ruck's an android too, right?
Well, they actually say he was there the entire time. He was the last machine that was left from the old ones, which is, by the way, a very Lovecraftian idea.
Yes, the old ones.
But there you go. There's some lawsuits waiting to happen, for, at least at that time. But Ruck was watching the machines And he was in a more advanced android. Makes you wonder, why were there two sets of androids? Or was there something that Dr. Corby made with the technology there? Like maybe they were just service models and Ruck was a more powerful service model? By the way, Ruck,
yes,
as you noticed, was Lurch from the Addams Family, played by Ted Cassidy, a huge man. And that's not his only Star Trek appearance. He's actually in voices in a couple of other things, including the Corbomite Maneuver and also in Arena. Those are two famous ones, which will be coming to, well, in a matter of weeks.
He's great. Yeah, actually. He's kind of really scary in this, voice. Don't you think? I thought he had a good commanding voice when he finally did speak. I was, again, when I was watching this, my jaw dropped when he picked up Shatner and held him, and I said, are there wires that we're not seeing? Is there a quick gimmick that's happening? And Matt assures me that this guy just picked him up and...
No, he's just strong.
Shatner, who's not a... Even back then, while he was thin, he doesn't seem like a small guy. He seems like he's muscly. I don't know. How tall is Shatner?
I don't know. I have to go Google that. But that guy, Cassidy, is a big fella. A big pal over there. He played sports. He was on radio. Just a large individual. But let's go Google that. And you tell us, but what did you think about when, upon meeting the alien robots, what he was doing to our fair red-shirted friends? Well, because you were like, oh my God, what were you thinking about on
again,
that
again, I don't exactly know. The story's all over the place. I mean, listen, this was a better concept and execution than Mudd's Women, like, which was just a bad, like, bad in its infancy, like, just a bad idea. This was a good premise. It's just like... They just had to go back and rewrite it and actually put it in scenes of people discussing what the hell was going on. Why did those guys get killed? Why did they kill the red shirts?
Well, it's because Corby gave direct orders saying, only you come down, and he only thought about that way. So Ruck, like a computer, it was transliterating literally what his orders were. So he got rid of them.
See, that's like, but Ruck is not... Why would Ruck be doing what these new people are telling him to do?
That's a really good question, isn't it? Now, Ruck does say that he was programmed by Corby, so maybe he was able to somehow figure out his programming. Corby is considered a genius, after all. He helped revolutionize medicine by transcribing Orion ancient texts. So the Orions are... actually not part of the Federation, but, you know, hey, at least the Federation also still doesn't really exist yet. But it is kind of interesting that he was able to somehow reprogram this giant machine guarding the place, and also figure out how to transfer his and Dr. Brown's consciousness to the robot bodies. But just even in that self, you know from the get-go, before any red shirt is dead, that there's something wrong with Brown right at the beginning. I mean, you had to know that right from the beginning, not only from the flashlight he's shining in everyone's eyes, but just the way he's acting.
Sure.
Did you think he was a robot at that point or anything?
No, I didn't think he was
thinking?
A robot. I didn't know what the premise of the episode was. That's the thing. I was trying to figure it out. There was never a turn. There was never a turn where it's like, oh my God, it's a robot. Spock, there are androids down here. And that would have been an amazing, like, that right there, talking about a missed opportunity. Spock, beam down here. There are beings of pure logic down here. Speak about them, about logic with them. Except, no.
Well,
he's in 30 seconds, there's a Rachel epithet, and moving on.
Well, actually, they're not really logical. I mean, the machines, this is actually an old story where the machines revolt. You have science fiction stories like When Harley Was One. That's another one of, things that I've actually read, where the machines or computers revolt. You have various things out there where people are afraid of technology. And in this one, we have to ask ourselves, who's the real Captain Kirk? And that's one of our other things over there where we have another
double
moment where we have, which a double, But the way, yes, as you were just pointing out, the way he kind of clues in Spock of Corby's evil plan to duplicate people with androids is to use mildly racist or actually racist language against Mr. Spock. I still think that's a... I don't know why, but that's always made me laugh and question, like, what does Kirk actually think of Mr. Spock in all this stuff? I mean, you would think they're friends, but they say, hey, the only way I'm going to get Spock's attention is to basically denigrate his heritage. It's kind of weird. They do mention it again.
Mind your own business, Spock. I'm sick of your half-breeded affairs, do you hear?
So you think Kirk could have used some, like, other special way to get Spock's attention?
I don't know. I don't even understand what exactly the main scientist's android's goal was, to make a universe of androids?
Yeah, that's not clear either. It doesn't tell you. I think it was just to replace everyone with androids. He's saying, like, everyone will be happy all the time, and Kirk rightly points out that, but you can also, whoever can programs it can... program in obedience and control and the counterpoint, but everyone will always be happy and no one will be sick. But what of love and emotion? Where will that be? And although at this point we see that Roger Corby does have emotion for Christine, you ask, wait, is everyone a robot? And, well, spoiler, yes, everyone is a robot on that planet. By the way, one thing I want to point out to you is that the other robot, Andrea, she didn't have a shirt. She had the same cross outfit as Brown, the assistant, but no shirt. I thought that was funny. In the book called These Are the Voyages, about the original series, they had to use special double-sided tape because Standards and Practices was walking around making sure that not too much skin was shown. On the outfit.
They did a great job because those were some good-looking ladies from the 60s. I'm not going to lie. Listen, it's weird when you look back and be like, okay, you know, your standards of beauty, I think, are somewhat subjective. And someone, you know, it's rare that in 2024 we look at someone from 60 years ago and be like, hey, good-looking gal. But not Star Trek is doing a pretty good job, like Uhura in the earlier episodes, and this lady right here, Nigel Barrett, not so much, but, you know, whatever.
Hey, Roddenberry liked her. That's the boss's future wife. They're not even married,
close
I believe,
personal
at this
friend
time.
Of yours.
But not a personal friend of mine. I just worked for her. The other thing I thought, just to jump back to Majel, what I found humorous was at the beginning when we find out that Corby is alive, or she is, Uhura gives her a hug, like, there you go, your fiance's alive. I did like the fact that Chapel's going like this, oh, you could make your own personal geisha, I see. Yeah, probably they picked that word because it sounds exotic, because geishas aren't really sex slaves, and I'm sure the Standards and Practices people would have said sex slaves. But who wouldn't want to build one of those? I mean, I wouldn't want to leave my wife for a very sexy android if I was trapped on a planet for 5 years.
Not
me.
Puff,
what about you,
absolutely
Mike?
Absolutely not.
No.
Where's the romance?
Be
There's
terrible.
No personality. I know
exactly.
What I mean.
Exactly. You would have to compute. I mean, just because Andrea's measurements are 36, 22, 55, as the text of the book I'm reading says,
alone.
Doesn't mean to be
no.
interested. Exactly.
Flim-flam.
I'd rather have my assistant Brown.
Just give me Brown. We'll play Scrabble together. I don't need no beautiful woman.
Well, I do like the fact that, so the idea was, is that, you know, obviously Corby wanted to take over the universe by having, to infiltrate some sort of colony on their way. That's where we get that famous line where obviously we just covered that. But I think the better part is on the set, for all of Standards and Practices' concern about over-sexualization, that stalagmite or stalactite that Shatner is grabbing, wow. What'd you think of the phallus over that one?
That's a joke, man, right?
Yeah, you would think so. Now no one notices it. No, that just got past the censors, but I did think it was absolutely hilarious.
There are literal testicles in that thing, man.
It's one of the funniest Star Trek images, and once you see it, you can't unsee it. I will tell you that. I'm happy I ruined it for you. But there's really not too much to this episode. We know that, but I will tell you that one of the interesting things is they actually refilmed the ending, or just the close-up, of Corby and Andrea embracing each other. Originally they had the phaser go off by accidentally. I think with Corby realizing that he's more machine than man now, and that he'll never have his fiance ever again, and he won't be the same human that he is. And also with Andrea discovering her humanity, I think he figured maybe we're monsters now, and he just decided to end it. It's kind of a weird ending, like, then to me on that. Did you feel something similar to that? That was very strange.
Of course, strange. Nothing happened. It was literally the first act of a normal episode. It's like, okay, that the first act got the premise, got basically what's going on, got the turn. There's going to be another Kirk going around, and then, you know, so what happens next? Then one of them goes up to the ship and they got to figure it out. Then Spock gets involved. McCoy figures out that one of them's an android. They go down. The Ruck gets onto the Enterprise and starts creating havoc. You know, they take hostages. Something. But nothing. It was just like...
Yeah, Nah.
Empty.
It's empty. it's like a half-filled-out plot, but I think part of that does go to the original writer with its Lovecraftian idea of like a mystery, something with like an ancient society that was brought down by its own hand, in the sense that its own machinery. Again, like you keep saying, it's all these nice ideas. It's just never fully brought out. And I think they were going for that mysterious type of thing, but a mysterious type of story. But from what I've read and understand, there were so many problems in rewriting this story and redoing it. They asked people to put in new dialogue and so forth. And, you know, it's hard to do that when you're running the TV show. Roddenberry took a turn at it. Robert Black, another associate producer, took a turn at it. A whole bunch of people did. And this was also running over budget each day. So it was 8 days of filming, believe it or not.
That's not many.
And, you know, when you got to get out. Yeah, but it's but remember, you got to do 26
I know,
of them.
I'm saying that's not a lot of time.
It's a lot. No. So this one was the exact price of this was $211,061, which is for 1966 quite a lot of money. I could probably do a conversion on it, but, you know, it still didn't do so wonderful. It lost down to The Dating Game. The Dating Game was right above it. And I don't know, you remember watching The Dating Game at all when you were younger?
The earliest notion that I have of anything like that was, I remember watching as a kid Love Connection. But
I remember that show.
And I remember they were like, using modern technology. Yeah, The Dating Game was funny. Modern technology? TVs? Like, I don't know. Even as a kid, I was like, man, it was weird. You know how I get like, even as a kid, I was like, there's going to be some good technology soon, right? Like.
Well, the paperless office is supposed to hit us as soon as 1973 rolls around. That was what I was always told. So I think we're a little proud. By the way, that episode today, according to something I found on the internets, a dollar in 1966 dollars is $9.47 today. So that episode would have cost $1,998,000.
That's a lot of money for nothing to happen.
I don't know how. Yeah, the set of the caves I actually liked. The cave set I liked. The rest of it, by the way, was pretty much stock footage, except for the bridge, if you think about it. The bridge and the transporter.
The cave still looked just like styrofoam, please.
Well, they did, but for what it is, if you take a look at it on a crappy standard definition television, it looked pretty darn good, actually, for a cave system. I do want to know what was like in those other hidden doors and so forth when they were walking down the hills. But overall,
there's not much to comment on.
I don't know if there's anything more to say.
Not a lot happened. Highlights of the episode, let's see. I thought Ruck was really cool. He looked great. He was intimidating. He was scary. And I also liked that he was like a little charisma. He wasn't just a heavy. He wasn't just a prop or a tool. I dug.
He also describes how they had to kill all the old ones. I thought that was actually interesting. He said they were illogical. And Kirk, and I think also this is actually, here's one point. Besides having red shirts die, Kirk pointing out to a kind of logicking or out-logicking a machine type of thing. This is one of many times that Captain Kirk uses his mental powers to make a computer do something it wasn't really meant to do or think about itself. Although, at the time, I think Ruck was thinking of killing Captain Kirk. But he did talk him out of his programming that whatever it is that Corby did.
That was the equation. Existence. Survival must cancel out programming.
But I'm sorry to interrupt, but you were saying that you liked Ruck, and what else did you like in the episode?
Let's see here. I like that they had some notion of... How do I say this? I like that they didn't... Okay, did you ever hear of a movie called The Sixth Day with Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Yes, that's the thing with the clones, and they have the little dot in their eyelid, so you know,
lesser Schwarzenegger, you know, not like on the same level of Total Recall or Terminator 2 or True Lies or anything, but not bad. Like, as a standalone sci-fi film, not bad, and I like that they, you know, when you have, like, oh, we're going to clone something, oftentimes... They're just making it from scratch, which of course would be crazy, a crazy amount of material and atomic energy and everything to make something from nothing. So in The Sixth Day, they start when they clone you with blanks, like generic male, generic female, and then they graft the technology, the genomes onto it, and it starts to like change into more of a human. So I like that they didn't just start with, here's a machine, click it. You know, you go in one side and two of you come out the other side. I like that they were like, okay, we're actually going to start with this big, weird, psychedelic, nightmare, green blob person that will turn into an android that looks like you. But, I mean, I'm telling you, like, Matt, in terms of drawing out the episode, when they just had the spinning merry-go-round thing going on for, like, 2 minutes and no one was saying anything... Like, obviously, they were like, oh, okay, we're coming in a little short here. But again, it's so weird. They could have had people having conversations about what was going on. They didn't have to, but I guess that would have required someone writing the dialogue.
Well, that's true. Well, I mean, this does remind me also, just what you were saying, like the sixth day, but there's also, there was a Ray Bradbury story that was, I think, done on one of the new Twilight Zones or Outer Limits called Marionettes Incorporated, We Shadow Forth, where you are actually replaced by an android, and some of the androids basically kill the copies of themselves, or they take over the lives of the people, the ultimate in identity theft. There's, like I've said before, there's a Harlan Ellison story with when Harley was one, and I think one of your favorite books, you know, what was it? I Have No Mouth, Yet I Must Scream.
Story,
You know, that's also a short story. There's also, it's again, a fear of technology. There seems to be a lot of fear of technology as we go along on this. And what is human? How we discuss it in relation to machines? This one was not done well. I mean, you and I could probably talk more about which is more important, human beings or...
Right.
Machines, or a combination of the both. And, you know, it obviously later extrapolated in Next Gen with the Borg and other things. But this is really, it's a quarter of a story. I don't really think there is much else to say, except that I think my WTF moment of this is the penis rock.
Yeah.
I think that's the only thing I really have. That and realizing it was Lurch. I think those are the two. It's like, oh my goodness, it's Lurch from the Addams Family.
Yeah, there was only so many big actors working in Hollywood at the time.
Yeah, yeah. That's really about all I think I can have to say on it. Do you have anything else you want to add to this, Mike? I mean, what are you going to give this on our very high-tech scientific scale on 1 to 10? 10 being the absolute best and 1 being garbage. I cannot remember
what I gave Mud's Women last week. I think I might have given it like a 2, a 4.
You gave it a 4. Oh, you gave Mud's Women a 4. So
okay,
what are you going to give this
back.
One?
Mud's Women is a 3. This is a 4.
Okay, I'm going to give this one a 5, almost a 6, only because I just like the idea of the mystery of what's going on in the city. But that's just me thinking ahead on this. Like, I wish there was more to it. So I'll give it a 50% like rating only for that, because it's still got some of the treks in there and it's got that rock. No, I actually like the episode up to a certain point, and I still think it needs to be fleshed out. But I don't know. What else can we say about it?
I do like that sometimes, because you and I have a pretty well-developed pop culture sci-fi retinue knowledge. It did remind me of a really cool short story from The Illustrated Man by Ray Bradbury called The City. Do you remember that one?
Actually, I have that one. Is that the one where the machine, the city takes over people, or
close.
Is that another
so
one?
So basically, these explorers are coming to a planet, and all they have in their logs is that the last time humanity had visited this planet was 20,000 years ago, and they didn't have anything else. And unbeknownst to them, 20,000 years ago, the humans had like destroyed everyone, had killed everyone. They were tyrants. So the people before they died made a city that would be like a trap if the humans ever came back, and the city has all these sensors and they smell the humans and weigh them and look at them and they realize that they're humans again. So they like suck the people one at a time into the city and truly gruesome, like slice them open and disembowel them and suck their skeleton out and make these like new android versions of them, with like Ray Bradbury describing it as like, you know, glass and electricity and wires. And then they go back to the spaceship to go back to Earth to take it over, you know, or at least to go and kill everyone. That's some plot there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, maybe that's why they were afraid of stealing these ideas. Like I said, this that everyone was realizing and legal and everywhere that, wait a minute, this story that was originally written, it's been stolen from other areas. In fact, they noted that the original author was borrowing things from himself. So he was self-plagiarizing, yeah. I guess, without giving credit. There was specifically, there was numerous elements traced back to a story called Queen of Metal Men and Almost Human. Those are from 1940 and 1943. And Come For Me, My Robot from 1954.
Okay, then.
In that story, by the way, was an underground Arctic city filled with robots, where they discover a female person who happens to be a robot. That sounds vaguely familiar, doesn't it?
Well,
but I bet you she was wearing a shirt. So,
well, in trying not to steal any ideas, they managed to have no ideas. So. There we
are. Exactly.
Anyway, what do we got on the channel for next week?
Next time on Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies, we'll be looking at Dagger of the Mind. Dagger of the Mind, a story about a mental institution, and we see what happens when we go to the Federation community and insanity. It's actually a very interesting story, at least I think so, but we'll watch it and discuss it then. But next week we're taking a brief respite because, depending when you're listening to this, it will be the Super Bowl. So we're going to take 1 week off, everyone, and we will see you again in 2 weeks with Dagger in the Mind.
Remind me to ask you, or note, only insane person, two insane people I remember seeing in Star Trek. Vulcan serial killer on DS9, and I think it was Betazoid serial killer on Voyager.
Well, this is not what you think okay. It is, but we'll find out when we see you next time at Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. So, night, Mike. I'll see you next time. Live long and prosper. Sir. All right. Take care. Bye-bye.